There's no doubt the American church is in crisis. After numerous scandals, the distrust of the church is at an all-time high. Young people raised in the church are leaving at an alarming rate. And we have a society where loneliness and spiritual hunger is rampant, but people are turning elsewhere for help. Welcome to The Roys Report, a podcast dedicated to reporting the truth and restoring the church. I'm Julie Roys, and today I'm going to be discussing the crisis in the American church with Sky Jathani. Sky is a former editor at Christianity Today and a former pastor. He's also co-host of the podcast The Holy Post, and he's a speaker and author of numerous books, including the provocatively titled What If Jesus Was Serious About the Church? In the book, Sky looks at what the Bible really says about the church. Then he compares that with some of the prevailing beliefs and values popular in the church today. For example, the church is commonly referred to in Scripture as a family. But in modern America, it's become a corporation. And in its pursuit of expansion, influence, and power, the church has sadly lost the essential Christian virtue of love. As Sky writes, now, rather than feeling like valued members of God's family, many church members feel like replaceable cogs in a ministry machine. Is it any wonder that the church is suffering, and is it any wonder that people are leaving? I'm so excited to speak with Sky about the church, not just because he's a great thinker and teacher, but because he's my brother. Sky attends the same house church that my family attends, and I've seen his commitment to the church on a day-to-day, week-by-week basis. And it's because of people like Sky that I haven't given up on the church, even though I've had a ton of negative experiences. I still believe in the church. I still see her beauty. And so I'm so excited to share this podcast with you. But first, I'd like to thank the sponsors of this podcast, Talbot Seminary and Marquardt of Barrington. Are you passionate about impacting the world so it reflects biblical ideals of justice? The Talbot School of Theology Doctor of Ministry program is launching a new track exploring the theological, social, and practical dimensions of biblical justice today. The program equips students with the knowledge, skills, and spiritual foundation needed to address social issues with wisdom and compassion. Justice has become a key issue in our culture, but more importantly, it's an issue that's close to God's heart. While it's clear the Bible calls God's people to pursue justice, we must be guided by His Word within that pursuit. Talbot has created this track to do just that. As part of this program, you'll examine issues such as trafficking, race, immigration, and poverty. And I'll be teaching a session as well, focusing on the right use of power in our churches so we can protect the vulnerable rather than harm them. So join me in a community of like-minded scholars committed to social change and ethical leadership. Apply now at talbot.edu/dmin. That's talbot.edu/dmin. Also, if you're looking for a quality new or used car, I highly recommend my friends at Marquardt of Barrington. Marquardt is a Buick GMC dealership where you can expect honesty, integrity, and transparency. That's because the owners there, Dan and Kurt Marquardt, are men of integrity. To check them out, just go to buyacar123.com. Well, again, joining me is Sky Jathani, a former pastor who now co-hosts the popular podcast, The Holy Post. He also speaks and writes books, including one that we're offering to listeners this month called What If Jesus Was Serious About the Church? So, Sky, welcome, and it's just such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Julie. I'm happy to be here.
And you may be surprised to know this, but I've actually mentioned you numerous times on this podcast. Do you know about this?
I do not, because I have to confess I have not listened.
You haven't listened to our podcast. Well, that's okay. But I've listened to The Holy Post. I've actually been on The Holy Post.
You have.
Which has been really fun. But I've mentioned you because I use this term that you coined called the evangelical industrial complex. And so whenever I do that, I try to give you credit. I say, you know, this isn't my term. This is Sky's term.
I don't need credit, but I appreciate it. It isn't like I get a kickback or anything from every time it's spoken, but yeah, I think it was 2012 I wrote an article that I first used that phrase, and it just took off. A lot of people have used it since then.
Well, it's a great term, but for those who are listening who haven't heard it before, what is the evangelical industrial complex?
Right. So it's a riff off of President Eisenhower in his farewell address to the country. It's on YouTube. I recommend people go watch it. It's very interesting. But he gave a televised address to the country where he warned about the military industrial complex. Of course, Eisenhower, having been a general and the commander of the forces in Europe during World War II, had a lot of credibility when it came to military stuff. And his concern was that there was this permanent arms industry that had been developed after World War II. And the military industrial complex, he said, needed a perpetual conflict and warfare to continue its business model. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of adopted that phrase, but talked about the evangelical industrial complex, which is this financial money-making industry that constantly needs celebrity leaders, celebrity pastors in particular, and big events to perpetuate its business model. And so it tends to elevate leaders who may be quite talented, but lack the character or the maturity to handle large audiences or significant influence. But the evangelical industrial complex will prop them up, publish their books, get them on the big stage, build a big platform for them in order to make lots of money off of this person's talent and reputation. And then we're shocked when they end up cracking under the pressure or falling into some controversy or their church implodes. And especially when I was working at Christianity Today, and I got around the country and I was seeing kind of behind the curtain in a lot of these places, I was noticing that tendency over and over and over again, where it wasn't the godly, mature, tested people who were given platforms. It was young, attractive, talented people who were given platforms. And so looking at this in different angles, like I just said, this is about making money. This isn't about really building up the church. And so that's the evangelical industrial complex.
And there's so much that you just said, just in those few paragraphs about the church and some of our assumptions about the church, the fact that we can have an industrial complex, the fact that we have so many financial interests. And we're gonna dive into a lot of that today. And I love your book because you take all of these things that are kind of, we've just adopted because we swim in this soup, right? And we don't even know kind of these false ideas about church that we've imbibed, but they're there. And when you begin to contrast them with scripture, you're like, oh my word. But as I mentioned in the open, you and I not only know each other professionally, but we go to the same church and we go to a house church, which is a very unconventional form of church. And I know for me and a lot of others within our house church, we've come because there was some sort of, well, I would say many of us are church refugees. Something happened at the church that we were at. And I know I've talked about this before on this podcast, that for us, it was losing trust in our leaders because of a sexual abuse cover-up at the church. And so that was very concerning. Your story, I'm guessing, is a bit different. And I realized as we jumped into this, I mean, I know your former church and I know some stuff that happened there, but I really don't know your story of why you came to this house church, which is really, in some ways, unconventional form of church. But if you read the New Testament, it sounds an awful lot like what they were doing back then. So, you know, what's your story? How'd you get there?
Quite by accident, really. So I was at the same church for 20 years. And for, I don't know, six, eight, it's hard to define, but I was on staff at the church for quite a few years. And then when I was at CT, I actually split my time between staff at the church and Christianity Today. So this convoluted time frame, but overall 20 years. And probably, gosh, I'm trying to get dates straight in my head. A few years before we landed at the house church, my wife and I were struggling, honestly, at the church. And I saw, I think partly because of my own ministry background and from my years at CT, where I had been around the country and seen behind the curtain at all kinds of different issues, mm-hmm. I had growing concerns about what I saw happening at my own church. And I took some of those concerns to some of the leaders. They did not share my perspective. They thought I was making a mountain out of a molehill. Mm-hmm. So in those years, my wife and I kind of decided, well, we're going to take a step back from like deeper involvement because I just saw yellow flags. Mm-hmm. And yet this was our community. This was the people we loved, people we'd known. Our kids were all born and raised in this church. So we were committed to the community, but I just decided as previously having been a significant leader there, I was going to take a step back. And those are hard couple of years because I was constantly torn, well, should we be somewhere else? Should I really wanted to be at a church where I felt like I could contribute my full strength and enthusiasm to the work of that community and everything. And it just wasn't going to happen mm-hmm. at our church in that season. Then 2020 happens and the pandemic hits. And it's like, oh, you know, God caused the global pandemic, so we don't have to go to church and feel awkward anymore in this situation. So like everyone else, our church closed. And so everyone moved online or figured out other alternatives. And a few months into the pandemic, Brady Wright reached out to me, mm-hmm. who's also part of our house church yeah. and a mutual friend. And he and I and our families have been friends for a long time. And he said that he knew a bunch of families that were all struggling with just feeling isolated. And it was still warm out. And he asked if we'd be open to gathering in someone's backyard under a tree, social distanced, mm-hmm. for like a fellowship gathering where we would read scripture, pray for one another, and just have a very, very rudimentary kind of worship gathering. So we started doing that in the spring and summer of 2020. And we thought this, and the people came from different churches, but we just said we needed fellowship. And a lot of us were connected through Young Life. And then as we got into the winter months, we realized, well, we actually really like doing this with each other. And our churches were still closed. And most of us were maybe engaging somewhere online, but not in a meaningful way. And then by 2021, the church that we had been a part of all those years went through that significant crisis that mm-hmm. it kind of finally blew up. And I had concerns that this was coming for years, mm-hmm. and then it did. And so when people found out that my wife and I had been a part of this little under a tree gathering thing, and then in homes after the weather got cold, some of those refugees started showing up at this little house church. And then there were other churches in our area, like yours, where mm-hmm. people were struggling and they ended up coming. And so before you know it, like Brady and I are looking at each other going, this was just supposed to be a COVID fellowship, temporary thing under a tree. But now we realize there's a bigger reason for this. And there mm-hmm. are people who need this place to feel connected and heal and a different way of approaching the basic functions of a Christian community. So fast forward, we're no longer at that church that we were at, obviously, for mm-hmm. 20 years. I'm no longer ordained in that denomination. And this house church has just become our community and home. So we didn't go into it as refugees from a church. We came into it just because of COVID, but it all kind of aligned with a number of years of suspecting things were coming. And then when they did, I think we were just a little ahead of the curve. I saw what mm-hmm. could happen and it did. And so maybe God was just sparing us from a more acute pain had we stayed more engaged.
And we were church refugees. And I kind of knew this, but when we lost what was our church home, we spent about 2 years visiting tons of churches in the area. And it just grieved me because I saw the same sort of system at every church that I just didn't believe in anymore. I still believed in the church. I still believed in God, but I didn't believe in the system anymore. And we're going to dive into that. And actually, in your introduction, I like how you talk about the church has changed. Our idea of what the church is has just dramatically changed in 50 years. And I would 100% affirm that. The church that I'm seeing everywhere right now that's called the evangelical church is not the church I grew up in at all. Not even close. So talk mm-hmm. about that change and what sort of prompted that change.
Gosh, I guess it depends on where you want to start the timeline. Mm. It's probably older than 50 years, but I think one of the significant changes that happened at some point in the mid-20th century was sort of the professionalization of pastoral ministry. Mm. And I don't mean professionalization as in professional training. I think that's very valuable. Mm-hmm. But here's what I mean. Throughout most of Christian history, a pastor or minister would spend most of their time during the week out in the community. Mm-hmm. They met people in their homes, on their mm-hmm. farms, in their factories, in the hospitals, in the prisons, wherever. They were out in the community engaging people. And then those people would congregate on Sunday, mm-hmm. and the minister would lead them in sacraments and in teaching of scripture and all that. But he or she knew their sheep because mm-hmm. they were out in the community. And at some point, we flipped a switch and we said, if you desire to be ministered to, you now need to come to where the minister works. You need to come into the church office, the church building, and we, the ministers, will create a plethora of programs for you and your family to minister to you. And that was done, I think, with very good intentions, and there's an efficiency in that. Mm-hmm. But I think what it unintentionally did is it caused those of us who are ministers and are pastors to lose touch with the reality of our sheep. We lost touch with what do people's lives actually look like Monday through Saturday. Because the only time we ever saw people, it was on our turf, on our terms, in our programs, and in our building. And once you made that switch from pastoral ministry out in the pastures to pastoral ministry in the professional setting of the pastor in their building, well, then it's just a matter of how do I scale this factory? How do I make more programs? How do I make bigger worship services? How do I get more people into this system? And then you get the explosion of mega churches and all of that. So, that was a big wake-up call for me, even after spending a number of years on staff at my church and then beginning to work outside. I realized, oh, I had no idea what the lives of the people in my church were actually like, because I only saw them in my context. I never saw them in their context. So I think that was a big change. And then you just get this massive growth of the institution, because you add into this concoction the sacred secular divide, and a lot of people in ministry think that the only work that really matters ultimately is ministry. So if something's going to matter, it has to happen under the church umbrella, which is how you get, like, you know, exercise facilities in a church. It's how you get auto mechanics in a church. It's how you get all these, because it has to be under the church to count, and you get these monstrosities, ministries. And in some communities, that's necessary. I don't want to completely diminish that, but you know, a lot of places it isn't. And then you need more and more professional people to manage and run these huge things. And that becomes the system that you're talking about. You're like, wow, this becomes really self-serving rather than ministering out into the community. I think that's one reason, is just the simple professionalization of what happened. There's a lot of other pieces of this we could unpack, but I think that one doesn't get enough attention.
Yeah. And it the church has become a corporation. It's right. It's not the family that a lot of us knew the church as. And I do think there were good intentions with things. Like, I remember the first time we went to Willow Creek, which is the big mega church in the Chicago area, much less big now that everything's happened with Bill Hybels. But I remember going, and the thing that struck me, because when I grew up in this little church, it was a great family, really great family, but nobody became a Christian there. Right? Like, nobody came to the church and became a Christian. And I saw Willow Creek putting on these amazing shows on Sunday morning, very attractional model. And I remember inviting my boss. I was doing this little sales job in between college and graduate school. And I invited my boss, and my boss became a believer. And then we started doing Bible studies, and we used to fill up two rows of people on midweek. Like, we'd have a sales meeting, and then we go to Willow, and literally there were dozens of people who became believers through that. So, I mean, that, I mean, at first I was just like, this is amazing. It's like the parachurch church. Like, I saw all of these parachurch type outreach ministries, but these, that model coming into the church. But then some really unintended consequences. You know, we really weren't thinking about it necessarily biblically. We were thinking about it pragmatically. How do we reach people? And that's kind of how we got there. But really, what is the church, right? I mean, that's what your book is getting to. What is the church? And I think you rightly say a lot of people think of it as an event, as a building, as an organization. So biblically, let's go back down to our roots, right? And what is the church?
The simplest answer is it's a community of women and men and children who have been redeemed by Jesus and are living in communion with him and one another. That's it. And that obviously can take different forms and structures and different cultures and times, but that's it. I think, you know, your observation that mega church functioned very much like a parachurch outreach kind of ministry, I think it's accurate. And I've been a part of a number, especially as a college student, a number of parachurch organizations like Campus Crusade or Crew now, InterVarsity, Navigators. And at least in my time connected to some of those things, they're very careful not to call themselves a church.
Right.
because they understand that we may be a ministry, we may do outreach and Bible studies and other things, but we are not a church. But the funny part is when you go to some churches that more or less function like parachurch ministries, they embrace the name church. And so I wrote a piece many years ago for Leadership Journal where I was arguing that these very large churches shouldn't really be called churches. And I started calling them VLMs, which is just very large ministries.
I'm going to start using VLM.
VLM, it's a very large ministry. And I tried to come up with a name that wasn't disparaging.
Yeah.
Because they are doing ministry. Right. They are reaching people like your colleagues, like they're doing good work. But there's something chafed on me about calling it a church when the historic definition and functions of a church community were really not present. But it was, they were preaching the gospel, they were teaching scripture, they were engaging non-believers, all that great. But the functioning of a church in many of these places was not actually happening. Parachurch organizations recognize that about themselves and stayed away from the label of church. But these mega churches and other ministries embraced the church name, all the while they weren't really functioning as churches.
And I think the pastor wasn't functioning as a pastor. I mean, we have pastors who are basically preachers, but they're not pastors. They're not shepherds.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You wrote one of the chapters is on, you know, whose church is it really? And it reminded me of an experience I had last fall. So I was doing some investigating on a church where Albert Tate was the pastor. It's in Monrovia, California. And he had admitted that he had an inappropriate texting relationship, but then his staff started complaining about bullying, about spiritual abuse. They found out that they really didn't have any say. They didn't own the church. The way the bylaws were written, Albert and a few of his key guys that he put on his board owned the church. And I remember at this very contentious town hall meeting that I went to, where they were basically the people were demanding their church back. And they were talking about Albert going on this sabbatical, and he came back really quickly. I forget how, it's several weeks. And then he said, and I'm just going to quote, he's like, I'm not sure if a month would have made any difference, like saying if I had stayed on my break for a month longer. And unfortunately, I still feel like this is my church. And the place erupted. I mean, people were saying, it's our church, it's our church. And then somebody was saying, no, it's God's church. But the way that we think about our church, I mean, there it was really coming to a head. And it really was a matter of who owns this church. And we've got legal ownership, and then we've got spiritual ownership. So speak to that, because I think we have really messed this one up.
Yeah. And I mean, this, there's a lot of pieces that intersect with this, because there's different polities. There's different church structures and governance structures, depending on your denomination and theology and all of that. And it gets complicated. You know, there's some denominations in which they might have congregational polity, but the denomination owns the building. It goes on and on and on. Like in the denomination I was a part of, they were congregational in their polity, but the licensing and ordination of clergy was handled by the denomination. So there was some oversight. And one of the things I used to have stronger opinions, I guess, about these matters. But as I've gotten around and had my own experience and just perhaps mellowed a bit with age, I've realized I have not yet found a church structure that cannot be abused. They all have weaknesses and they all have strengths. Some, I think, are better than others, but they're none's immune. So if someone's looking for a silver bullet of how do we structure these things to avoid abuse, good luck. The best you can do is try to mitigate against it in your culture and environment by choosing certain models versus others, but they can all be abused. But what you're getting at in the story that you mentioned, and I've seen this up close as well, especially within evangelicalism, so much of our tradition is rooted in charismatic personalities, and lowercase c charismatic personalities, so that we tend to associate a church with its visible leader, the person in the pulpit. I remember Outreach Magazine, I think it was Outreach Magazine years ago, used to do an issue every year on like the top 100 churches in the country or something like that. And they measure just based on size, based on attendance. And it was like a centerfold, a fold out, you know, big thing that, and they'd list all these churches in this chart, and there was the name of the church, and then there was just the headshot of the senior pastor. That was the visual representation of that church. Right. And so it is a structural problem, but it's also a people problem. We do that. Mm-hmm. We do that because we tend to pick a church based on, do I like the preacher? Mm-hmm. And if that's the criteria you have for picking your church, you're reinforcing that same idea. And what really grieved me was when I realized, despite the rhetoric, despite the theology, despite all the words about we're a body and it's, you know, blah, blah, blah. When people in leadership, John Ortberg used to say that there's, the, you know, everyone has their mission and then there's the shadow mission. There's what you say your mission is and then there's what your mission really is. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered in some of these places is you might say your mission is the health of the church or it's the growth of the church or it's the service of the community, whatever it might be, glorifying God. The shadow mission in an awful lot of these places is to protect the pastor and to maintain the pastor's status and reputation. And that for me, to speak about the system being broken, is when I lost trust and hope, where it ceased to be about what's best for the body and it became what's best for the figurehead who represents the body, not Jesus, but the pastor. Mm-hmm. Again, there's a bazillion stories of how this happens, but I don't want to point the finger just at the system because we are complicit in creating that system. Mm-hmm. Because I think for a lot of us, we get a lot of satisfaction after saying, that's my pastor, that's my leader. Look how great my guy is. Look how many books he's published. Look how popular his radio show is. And I'm a part of that. So there's something we get from that, which props them up. And it's this and somewhere else I wrote about it as being like the relationship between an animal and a zookeeper. Like they both benefit. The animal gets fed in a safe place to live and the zookeeper gets the satisfaction of, you know, being in charge of all these animals. And if you're content with that model, we're going to continue to have this dynamic where the leaders are synonymous with the church and then the church does everything it can to prop up and protect its leader. And it's really unhealthy for everybody involved.
That's interesting. And it is true that it's comfortable for us because when we go to a church like that, everything's provided for us and we don't really have to bring anything to the table. And that's been one of the challenges with our house church, hasn't it? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like we're like, nobody signed up to facilitate this week. Nobody signed up for worship leading. And it's like, okay, yeah, we're going to have to bring a little more to the table if we're going to keep meeting. But again, biblically speaking, I mean, there's commands about when you meet together, you should bring a psalm, you should bring a word of encouragement, you should bring, I mean, all of these things. We've gotten into a very consumeristic way of looking at church and of approaching it. And it's on us. You're right. You're 100% right. It is on us. And I think we don't think of the church as God's church. But if we do think of the church as God's church, then I think it also changes our expectations of who should be in that church. You mentioned how a lot of churches, when they plant a church, they'll talk about their target audience, for example.
Right.
Which implies you can either be in their target or not be in their target, right? So if you're not in your target, then do you count? Do you, you know, I mean, do you matter? A lot of like assumptions there. But when we think about church and we think about who's coming, how should we perceive that?
Yeah, I think that the breakdown here is the way our culture defines hospitality. Hmm. When you think, again, it's become an industry. There's the hospitality industry in the modern world. And so what we usually mean by hospitality, and this trickles down even to our homes. Like when we think about, do you have a hospitable home? You think, well, if I'm going to have guests, I'm going to find out what do they like? What do they want? I'm going to accommodate to their needs. I'm going to make sure that, you know, they're vegan or whatever it is. And we're going to customize our home to fit the people who are coming. Mm-hmm. And that the hospitality industry has taught us, whether it's, you know, airlines or hotels or resorts or whatever, find out who you're marketing your resort to and then give them what they want. Mm-hmm. Customer is king. And mega churches and the seeker movement came along and they adopted that same approach. Well, we're going to go after unchurched Harry and Mary, famously was Willow Creek's thing. Right, and they had this middle-aged people and they tailored a church around what they wanted. That's very different from the ancient world's understanding of hospitality. You know, Paul commands us to be hospitable to one another. And so does Peter. And it's a very ancient idea going back to Abraham, being hospitable to the strangers who are angels who came to his home. In the ancient Near East, hospitality was not about catering or changing your home or community to accommodate your guests. It was instead welcoming guests into the normalcy and flow of your home as it is. It's being authentically yourself, but welcoming those guests into it. So, I'll give you one example. When I was in seminary, some classmates of mine did an experiment where they took two television monitors to Northwestern University, right? This secular university in Evanston, the north side of Chicago.
Where I got my graduate degree.
Right. Yeah, that's right. One monitor, they showed a Catholic mass. And the other monitor, they showed a very contemporary megachurch worship gathering. And they asked students as they came by, hey, if you were ever to go to church, which one of these would you go to? And this would have been, you know, probably 1998, 99 in that time frame. The overwhelming response of the students was the Catholic mass. And then they asked them, well, why is that? And they said, well, that looks like a rock concert. That looks like I can get that anywhere, but that looks sacred. That looks holy. And what they were getting at was, you know, the mega churches said, we're going to accommodate to the culture and give people what they want. But increasingly with my generation, and I think the younger ones, it smacks of pandering. It smacks of, well, you're changing who you really are in order to be who you think I want you to be. Whereas the Catholic mass to a lot of these students was like, well, that's they're being authentic to who they are. That's Christianity. That's, they're not trying to, I mean, goodness, the Catholics just started doing the mass in English not that long ago, right? I mean, they very slow to accommodate, but that was seen as authentic. So I think that the challenge for us today is not how do you change the church to be what the culture wants you to be? It's how do you be authentically Christian in your church community, but how do you make it as accessible as possible to the people who might come in? So in our case, like when we gather, we take communion every Sunday when we gather. And I know plenty of secret churches that would say, you don't do that because it's off-putting to non-believers who don't understand it. I would hope that if someone came into our community, and I've seen churches that do this really well, who take communion regularly, they explain what this is, what it means, why we do it, how to do it, the significance of it, and invite people to participate or not, depending on their theology. But that's being hospitable. It's not changing who you are to accommodate people's expectations. It's welcoming them into who you are. And to the normal flow of your family and household. And I think that's a better approach and a more faithful approach than polling the community and finding out what they want.
Absolutely. And I love that we do communion every week. And I think a lot of churches have forsaken this. In fact, you talk about the, what is it, the coffee bar versus the Lord's table. Like in a lot of these churches, the coffee bar has become more appealing than the Lord's table to these churches, again, because I think their mentality is, we're doing church. And this is where, you know, I feel like evangelism, which is such an important thing, but it's almost superseded worship. Like we forget why we come together. We don't come together to reach the seeker. Not that God, you know, obviously Jesus cared. He left the 99 to get the one, but we come together to worship God. You know, I mean, that's the primary. And so the table, you know, describe, well, I mean, beyond what you've talked about, but theologically, why is the table so, and by the way, our Restore conferences, every single one, we always end with communion, which I've had people come up to me and say, oh, you shouldn't do like anything that might trigger people because they were hurt in the church and communion, you know, that's something that's very churchy. And I'm like, we have to redeem these symbols. We can't throw them out because these symbols are there. God gave them to us because our souls need them, and we need to have this communion with one another and with Christ. I know this is a conviction of yours that's very deeply held, but why is the table like a non-negotiable for us as believers when we meet?
Let me give you two reasons, although there are more. One is I think it is the practiced embodiment of the gospel. It is not just the verbal proclamation of the gospel, which is obviously valuable, but it's the embodiment of the gospel. And in the sense that it's not just a memorial to Jesus' death, mm-hmm. which certainly it is that, my broken body, my shed blood. Mm-hmm. But in sort of an Ephesians 2 kind of way, where there Paul talks about how on the cross, God has reconciled us to one another. He's talking mm-hmm. about Jew and Gentiles mm-hmm. there. He's broken down the wall of hostility and he mm-hmm. has reconciled us to one another, made us one new person, and then together reconciled us mm-hmm. to God through the cross. So it's not just when I sit alone and take a little juice and a little bread and I kind of think about the cross and my communion with God. It's when I am sitting side by side or standing side by side with my sisters and brothers, realizing I'm one with them because of the cross. Mm-hmm. And he has reconciled us to one another, people maybe who I share something in common with in an earthly way, but some whom I don't. Mm-hmm. And so when we don't practice communion regularly, I think we can easily fall into the trap of losing the horizontal dimension of the gospel. Mm-hmm. And we make it simply vertical. It's just me and God. And we forget, no, it's the reconciliation between brothers and sisters happens first, Paul says, and then we're reconciled to God the Father, or Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. If you're going to make an offering at the altar and there remember your brother mm-hmm. has something against you, leave the offering, go be reconciled to your brother, then come mm-hmm. and offer your gift to God. Like he always puts the horizontal reconciliation ahead of the vertical. Mm. And we have so lost sight of that. And we don't think that's essential to our gospel, but it is. Mm. So the table is critically important because it is the embodiment of that full gospel, the horizontal and the vertical. And when we don't practice that, we get really warped. And it leads to terrible things in the church. Then the other reason, the second reason, and this gets a little bit more into that coffee bar versus communion table thing, is virtually everything in our society is designed to make us narcissistic consumers. It's all about me. It's what I want. Mm-hmm. And when I go to a coffee bar, I don't drink coffee. I drink tea. But when I go to a Starbucks or whatever, mm-hmm. like there's infinite options and I pick what I want and I'm the one in charge and I order it and I get it. And a lot of churches have that in their foyer or communion area or mm-hmm. a common area, whatever it might be. Fine. I'm not against coffee in church, but the table, I'm no longer in charge. Mm. It's Christ's table. It's not my table. And even if I'm officiating and I'm a pastor at the table, it's still not my table. It's Christ's table. Mm. He welcomes us there. This is his body. This is his blood. Mm. This is about his kingdom and his family. And it's a reminder that I am not in charge and I belong to something other than myself. Mm-hmm. And so those two realities of the gospel, I think, are antidotes to what we get bombarded with in our culture mm-hmm. of the privatization of our faith. It's just me and God, and the hyper narcissism of it's what I want that matters, not what God wants. For me, the practice of communion inoculates me to a degree against all of that cultural garbage and realigns me to the gospel of Christ again. So to not practice it regularly, I think, is to lose one of the greatest graces that Christ has given his church. And especially in our context, we need to do that.
Hmm. And I love about the table too, it especially this is probably why I absolutely love liturgical worship, which is something I loved about our previous church because it was Anglican and I loved the liturgy, but I love the table because it reminds us of what's coming. Mm-hmm. Like the wedding feast that we're looking forward to. I think way too often in, especially in evangelicalism, it's like our goal is to get people saved and then it stops. Like we forget right. that we're saved to be part of this community that's being redeemed and has this glorious thing that we're anticipating. And I think most Christians forget we're anticipating something. You just get the sense like, oh, you got saved, you've arrived, you know, and then, well, you should become disciple. That's important. Of course, we, as you point out, we haven't really defined what disciple is, but that's important. But we forget, man, we are just passing through. We've got this glorious, glorious feast that we're waiting, and it is going to be a family, and it's going to be a family affair where everyone's gathered. And I love that part of it. And I love that it takes us out, like you're saying, out of our present context and reminds us who we are and where we're going. So love that part of it. And you touched on this when you said you were hinting at the transactional nature that mm-hmm. we come to church with. And I hear this all the time. I've probably said it myself. So I'm sure I have. I'm sure I've been guilty of this. But we look at church and we say, and if we go and we don't feel like we were especially inspired or something, we'll say, I didn't get anything out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about why that's really not the way we should be approaching church.
Oh, gosh. Julie, I wrote my very first book on this whole thing, mm-hmm. which no one read. It's called The Divine Commodity, and it's all about mm-hmm. consumerism and the church, with a weird thread of Vincent van Gogh all the way through the book, which is why no one read it.
That sounds very interesting, though, in a
weird,
dark sort of way.
Book.
Yeah.
Yeah. We live and move and have our being in a consumer culture. Everything mm-hmm. is measured by its value to me. It's interesting, like there's an economist who argues that America really transitioned into a truly consumer economy in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And it's the 1950s where you begin to see a massive spike in divorce rates. Now, mm-hmm. there's a lot of factors into that. It's not just economics, but I think it's a factor.
Yeah.
Because what consumerism tells us is that the world exists to satisfy my desires. Mm-hmm. And when something doesn't satisfy my desire, I'm justified in changing it, whether it's a product from a shelf or a spouse that I said I was committed to. So we measure everything that way. Most of us don't even think twice about it. Of course, that's the right way to live. Of course, that's what the world is all about. And so we come into our church communities or even our relationship with Christ and we go, well, what have you done for me lately? And is this beneficial to me? And am I getting something from it? And we don't challenge that ethic in mm-hmm. most of our churches. We never point it out. We never go, hey, this might be the way economics works in our society, but it's not the way the most important things work. This isn't the way we should think about our children. This isn't the way we should think about our spouses. And this is not the way we should be thinking about God, and certainly not the way to think about his church. But we do. And in a weird way, the First Amendment has reinforced that idea. We have no established church in America, and mm-hmm. I'm grateful for that. But it also means there's a free market of religion in the United States, and the religious institutions that are out there are all competing for a part of the market. They're competing mm-hmm. for customers. And in that setting, the customer's king, you give them what you want. So it ends up reinforcing this mindset over and over and over again. I can't, you know, just shake my fist at the culture and go, oh, big, bad consumerism. But what I can shake my fist at a little bit are churches and ministers that aren't speaking about this dynamic and helping people be formed out of it into the values of the kingdom of God. And instead, we either stay silent about it or flat out reinforce it and advance it in a weird way. So yeah, things like communion, like commitment, like relationship, like service are antidotes to some of that mindset. But it's hard. And I find myself in that posture all the time as well. You can't escape it. It's just part of who we are as 21st century modern people. That's where it's on the shoulders of church leaders and institutions to help form us and give us a vision of a different way that very few are doing.
Similar to that is, I think, this idea that when we come to church, we do so, and we've heard churches build themselves this way. We come and experience God. Right. And worship has become, and it's interesting to me because worship was so huge in my development as a Christian. As I remember being in high school and I got discipled by these Oral Roberts Jesus people, like wacky charismatics who, you know, were druggies maybe 10 years prior to meeting me. But they were so on fire for the Lord. And we would get together and we would pray and worship. And literally we'd be there for 3 hours and it would seem like 10 minutes. Like it was just an amazing, like, I didn't realize up until that point that you could have that kind of intimacy with God and that kind of communion with him. So worship was huge to me in my experience of God. What's been challenging now, and even I look back, we were in a vineyard church for a long time, and I used to love to invite people, and I would see them come into the worship and they just start crying. And they don't even know why they're crying, right? They're just crying because they're moved. But now I'm seeing so many of these worship experiences that are, they're amazing emotional experiences. And it's making me check. Like I have a check now because I'm like, I see these kids like raising their hands and they're praising the Lord. And then the rest of what they're doing throughout the week has nothing to do with the Lord, has nothing to do with worshiping the Lord. And I see these ministries that are built on worship, you know, like Hillsong and Bethel. And now we're seeing just such horrible manipulation and corruption and abuse within so many of these churches. And so the whole experiencing God thing, and it's hard to even parse out, like, is the music affecting me? Is God, you know, and I think if you try to parse that out, then you're kind of killing the experience itself, you know, right? So you destroy it. But I think this idea that we have to go to church to experience God has been baked into evangelicalism where it's at right now. So address that and why we need to really change our focus when it comes to worship.
You and I were very different high school students.
We were. You were here. I was here, right?
Yeah. So I was the worst kid in the youth group in high school because I was such a skeptic. Yeah. I used to get dragged to these big worship events in Chicago for high schoolers in the early 90s. And I just thought these are the most manipulative and emotionally charred. I just didn't buy it. I never bought it. And that was my own baggage and problem. But let me say that I think the problem is not necessarily these gatherings. Mm-hmm. I think they can be beautiful in many. And I've been a part of some that are, you know, just amazingly gorgeous times of communion with God. The problem is not the gatherings. I think the real problem is what we expect to get from them. Mm-hmm. And here's the metaphor that I've written about elsewhere that I find helpful. In 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul references Moses on the mountaintop of Sinai when he meets with the Lord. And if you remember the story from Exodus 34, when Moses came down the mountain to meet with the people again, they all freaked out because his face was glowing, right? The radiance of God was shown on his face. And in Exodus, it says that Moses put a veil over his face so that people wouldn't freak out anymore. Well, Paul, when he's referencing this in 2 Corinthians 3, adds a little bit of rabbinical tradition into the story that's not actually in Exodus, but Paul was familiar with. And he said, no, the real reason that Moses put a veil over his face is because he didn't want the people to see that the glory was fading away, that it was only temporary. Mm. And so when you piece these things together, you get a sense of what was really going on here. Is every time Moses would go up the mountain to meet with the Lord, he would take the veil off and he'd kind of get recharged. Another zap of God's radiance, and he'd come down and everyone would see, oh, he's been with the Lord, he's glowing, and then he'd put the veil over because it fades away. And I think that's a little bit what we've gotten caught up into, is an external mountaintop kind of communion with God. Moses' experience on the mountain was real. It was genuine. It was good. It was full of God's presence. The problem that Paul's pointing out is it always faded. It was temporary. And so you have to go back over and over and over again. And he contrasts that with the new covenant in Christ, which he said is not about an external glory. It's about his spirit within us, transforming us from one degree of glory to the next with ever increasing glory so we can take the veil away. And this is the core problem, I think, in an awful lot of consumeristic American evangelical Christianity, is essentially what we have done is rejected the new covenant in Christ. In favor of the old covenant in Moses. And the reason is, if we really buy the new covenant in Christ, you don't need a $50 million mountaintop to encounter God. And you don't need a dynamic preacher to encounter God. And you don't need a huge worship band to genuinely encounter God. What do you need? You need to cultivate a deep, abiding presence with his spirit, the kind that Jesus talks about in John 15. Abide in me and I will abide in you, just as a branch abides in its vine and bears fruit. That's New Testament spirituality. But if you want a big ministry, and if you want thousands or even millions of people buying your albums and coming to your church and doing anything, then you need Old Testament spirituality. You need to convince people that the only place that they're really going to have an experience of God is on the mountain that you've built and that you hold the toll road to accessing.
That's good.
That's Old Testament spirituality, and it's really lucrative, but it's not what we're called to in Jesus. So that's what worries me, is we're creating kind of worship junkies where they need another hit and the glory fades and they're like, oh, my life, I felt really transformed after going to that big event, that big conference, that big whatever, But yeah, a week later, the glory fades and you're back to the person you always were. And then you go, I guess I need to go again, or I need a bigger thing, or a better church, or a better speaker, whatever. And all the while, we're ignoring what we're called to, which is, who's teaching me how to really commune with Jesus? Who's teaching me how to pray? Who's teaching me how to confess my sins? Who's teaching me how to really live in step with the Spirit day in and day out, so that I might truly be transformed from one degree of glory to the next? Very few of our mega ministry settings are designed to do that kind of work. They're designed to give us a show and make us feel great. And to be fair, again, sometimes those are genuine encounters with God, just like Moses was, but it always fades. That's the problem.
Well, and I'm thinking back to when I was at Vineyard, and there was a saying that John Wimber had that I absolutely loved. And he would say, pretty much everything else in our experience with God is something that he does for us. Worship is the one thing that we do to him, that we give back to him. And I think rightly understood, it comes from that communion with God that you have, that then when you, when you have the chance to verbally express that, you know, it's very much like in a marriage relationship, when you have that opportunity to physically express that love to your spouse, it's extraordinarily meaningful, because why? You already have that love that you experience one for another. And so then that physical expression becomes so meaningful. But if it were just the physical expression without the love, you know, and I think that's where a lot of people are at, really, in the way that they're relating to God.
Right. Yeah. If we developed a genuine communion with God throughout the week, and then we gather with our sisters and brothers on the weekend and express that, that's wonderful. I think too many of us, again, schooled as consumers, don't have that communion all week long. And then we show up on Sunday going, light me up, make me feel good, you know, give me that charge so that I can go into my week and feel encouraged or blessed or whatever it is I'm looking for. That's not worship.
And we don't want to disciple people in how to maintain that in their private life, because then they don't need us. And
exactly.
Yeah. So good. Well, there's so much more we could talk about. I do want to, before I let you go, talk just briefly about leadership. And you've touched on it somewhat, you know, about the, you know, the celebrity pastors. You also used a term that's become somewhat of a buzzword within the church, is something called servant leadership. It's, I have a feeling that's much more about the upfront and not the shadow, like the shadow mission shows whether that servant leadership is actually a thing. But talk about that leader, and the approach that that leader should have, how a leader should serve within a body. And why maybe we should be suspicious of those who come along and say they're visionary leaders and they're going to impart their vision to us for the church. And I know I just gave you a big one, didn't I?
It is a big one. And this, there's so many landmines in this.
Yeah.
I generally don't like using the language of servant leader, because especially again, in American evangelical culture, it's, the assumptions behind it are misunderstood. So let me unpack that a little bit. Usually when we think of servant leader, we think of a person with authority or power who nonetheless does humble acts of service, right? So it's the pastor who's out there shoveling the snow, or you know, the church leader who's still taking out the garbage, and you go, gee, look at Pastor Steve. Isn't he humble? And he's a servant leader and he's doing that thing, just like Jesus washed the disciples' feet. It's great. I'm glad a pastor does that. Like, I certainly wouldn't want to disparage it, but I don't think that's really what servant leadership means. In John 13, that scene where Jesus washes the disciples' feet, what he's really doing there is not only humiliating himself, he's humiliating his disciples. They had been arguing about who's the greatest. And then Jesus strips naked and starts washing their feet, taking this grotesquely humiliating role. And he gets to Peter, and Peter's like, there's no way you're washing my feet. And he says, if you don't let me wash your feet, you can have no place with me, which is like, wow, that's a pretty strong statement. What's going on there? In that culture, the relationship between a rabbi and a disciple was well established. And a disciple's identity was completely defined by who their rabbi was. So when Peter and John and James and the others, when they left their fishing boats and their toll booths and all the other things they were doing to become a follower of Rabbi Jesus, Peter especially was thinking, this is a pretty good deal because I'm leaving a meager fishing business to become the disciple of the most powerful guy I've ever seen, who's probably going to take over the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why, who am I going to get to sit at your right, on your left? Where am I going to get? Yeah. Like, this was a great deal because my rabbi is like bigger than Moses. And then he sees his rabbi do the most humiliating and embarrassing task imaginable. And so what Jesus is saying to Peter is, if you think this is humiliating to me, it's even more humiliating for you, Peter, because I'm your rabbi, which means you're even lower than me. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the whole scene, he says, I, your teacher and rabbi, have done this. You should do likewise. I think the message he's really saying there is, stop caring what others think about you. And love in a self-sacrificial way. Take up your cross, die to yourself and follow me. So when I then look at what does that mean in 21st century American church world, nobody is going to look at a pastor shoveling snow or taking out garbage and go, oh my gosh, what a loser. Most church world go, oh, that's great. He's doing something noble and kind and helping out and everything. No one's going to think he's a humiliated nothing because of that. So what I'm looking for is a pastor who has given up on their own reputation, who doesn't care how many followers they have on Twitter, who's not worried about, are they going to have a best-selling book, isn't counting how many people showed up every Sunday because that's a stroke to their ego. It's where they have truly died to themselves. They know who they are and where they're going, and like Jesus did at the beginning of John 13. They know they belong to God, and they know they've been called by him, and they're set free then to love sacrificially without caring about their own reputation and ego. So that's, I think, a better definition of a servant leader, the person whose ego is not driving their ministry. That's hard to spot without real relational connection and knowing somebody well. So I'm all for that kind of servant leader. And it's rare. I've known men and women like that. Sometimes they have an ecclesiastical title, sometimes they don't. But they are the salt and light in the church today. And I pray that God will bring us more of them because we desperately need them in the American church.
I love that. That's so good, Sky. Thank you. Well, we have to wrap this because I've got my grandson's first soccer game coming up. And I've got to boot out of here to go to go see that.
I actually have a soccer game tonight, too, for my high school daughter. So I've got to do that, too.
But this has been really good and really rich. And I so appreciate this book that you've written. And like we said, we're offering that to anybody who gives a gift to the Roy's Report this month. So just really grateful for you, Sky. And I think people, when they hear this, they're like, wow, that guy's in your church. And we have like so many people who are deep thinkers like this in our church. And it's been an incredible gift. And it's been an incredible thing to, you know, iron sharpening iron, which we've had that opportunity. So just feel blessed to have you as my brother and just appreciate this time
likewise
we spent.
And thankful for all the good work you and your team at the Roy's Report are doing in helping people navigate a really difficult season in the church and hopefully find healing and deeper communion with God and one another. It's valuable work. I'm grateful to have a small little role in this podcast now as a part of it.
And you're going to have to watch this podcast now. It'll be your first.
Yes, I probably will.
Well, blessings to you and thanks so much.
Thanks, Julie.
And thanks so much for listening to The Roy's Report, a podcast dedicated to reporting the truth and restoring the church. I'm Julie Royce. And just a reminder, we're giving away Sky's book, What If Jesus Was Serious About the Church, to anyone who gives a gift of $25 or more to The Roy's Report this month. As I often say, we don't have advertisers or big donors at The Roy's Report. We simply have you, the people who care about reporting the truth and restoring the church. So if you're passionate about our mission, please go to Julie Royce, spelled ROYS.com/donate, and you can give there. Again, that's JulieRoyce.com/donate. Also, just a quick reminder to subscribe to The Roys Report on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. That way, you won't miss any of these episodes. And while you're at it, I'd really appreciate it if you help us spread the word about the podcast by leaving a review. And then, please share the podcast on social media so more people can hear about this great content. Again, thanks so much for joining me today. Hope you were blessed and encouraged.